Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, I'm Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. Welcome to More Than Masala. Today is so special because we are interviewing the absolute icon herself, Chef Manit Chauhan. And believe me, I cannot say enough, this is an absolute honor for Ragini and I. The interview was absolutely mind-blowing with the wisdom that Chef gave us and just how humble and kind she is. Stay tuned because there are some really, really amazing questions that we asked Chef Manit. And yeah, you guys are in for a great one. Let's go. And we're recording here. Cool. So yeah. Oh, I'm excited. Well, first of all, thank you, Manit, so much for
jumping.
Yeah, this is like super cool. And a fun little story to start this off. So there's kind of this 6 degrees or 7 degrees of separation between us. So in 2020, I do a lot of work with the American Culinary Federation. And one of my good friends is Jackie Pressinger. And she was like, hey, we want you to take main stage in Nashville for an event. And I was like, oh, super cool. Jackie and I have known each other for years. And, you know, for, 10 years, I've studied food from the Indian subcontinent. And she's like, you know, you really need to meet Manit. And I was like, yeah, right. You know, like, let me just throw that out there. And she's like, no, really, she's so cool. She's so down to earth. So Nashville was going to happen. We were going to come to the restaurant, reach out to you, have just a blast, and then COVID. And so we, it was heartbreaking for so many reasons that were way more than me. But it's good to finally meet you, and it's nice to have that connection. So welcome to More Than Masala.
Thank you so much. And after today's conversation, there's 1 degree of separation, as simple as that. We love Jackie, but it's okay, Jackie. Now we have a direct contact.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege. I followed your career as just a fan and somebody who, you know, really looks up to all the stuff that you do and the work that you put in. You know, like, I think that's one of the things that we want to touch on today.
I'm just going to pipe in real quick to say that, like, as a North American South Asian woman also, like, I just want to definitely give you a massive shout out for that, because I think looking at it from that perspective, it's always really inspirational to see people doing the things that either you want to do or you've seen populated in other ways. And so, from a little further afar and with less culinary skill than Keith, I've also followed your career for a while. So it's really great to have you on here.
I'm excited to be having this conversation with y'all.
Ragini always downplays her skills, but she's so talented. I always look up to her. So. Here we go. Let's start from the beginning. Manit, if you could give us a little bit about kind of your backstory and how you got to where you are today, I would love that.
Oh my God, how much time do we have? Just kidding. You know, I grew up in India. I was born in Punjab in northern India, but grew up in a really small town in eastern India called Ranchi. It's close to Calcutta or Kolkata right now. And the fun part about growing up in this community, my dad was an engineer. So, you know, there were people from all over India in that community. And as you guys know that, you know, regional Indian cuisine is so diverse. What was cooked in our house in a traditional Punjabi household was completely different from what my neighbors were cooking, who were from Andhra or from Bengal or from Odisha. So I literally was that obnoxious kid who would finish dinner at home, then go over to my neighbors' houses and ask them, if I could eat with them because my parents hadn't fed me. And it was incredible because I got to taste ingredients, I got to see ingredients, I got to see techniques that were not being used in my own house. I mean, in fact, everybody, you know, they were so, my love of cooking was so deep that, like, the older I got, my, you know, if they were get-togethers or parties, they would call up my parents and say that, you know what, dinner starts around at 7, so you guys come at 7. But Maneet, could you send her around at 3 o'clock so that she could help us cook? And it was incredible. To me, the most amazing part. And that's the time I think I really started thinking of food as a career. And then when my older sister went to do her undergrad, I would go to visit her and I would take food. And soon I realized that I was the most popular kid on campus and I didn't even go to school there. I'm like, aha, this is it. Like, do something that you love and people love you for it. That was a no-brainer. I did grow up in a community where, you know, at a time where all the kids were, you know, studying to be either doctors or engineers, or if you're really looking outside the box, maybe an accountant or a lawyer. And over here, I'm like, I want to be a chef. And everybody's like, okay, like, you're not that dumb. You if you study hard enough, you can still be an engineer. And I literally, like, my parents were, they pretty much were like, back off, let her do what she wants to. And the only advice that they gave me was, do whatever you want to, whatever you love, just make sure that you give it your best and you're the best at it. And that's the mantra which I've held very close to my heart right now. And then I went to the best hotel administration school in India, because culinary schools, exclusive culinary schools in India at that time weren't there. And then in my final year, I asked my chef instructor, the best culinary institute in the world to go to, and without even batting an eyelid, he said the CIA, Culinary Institute of America.
That's awesome.
I really love that phrase that you said, do something you love and people, and do something that people love you for. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I think food is something that, like, inevitably you just immediately touch people's hearts, minds, bodies, like everything, you know, like one bite and you're fan for life.
You know, but it also was, I think I did not realize it when I was a kid, the profound effect that food has on people and relationships. I remember going over to my neighbor's houses and, you know, auntie, as in India, we don't call, you know, people of our generation, of our parents' generation by their first name. It's either uncle or auntie. And auntie was from Andhra and she would speak Telugu, which is, you know, a language spoken over there. I didn't know Telugu. And she used to struggle with Hindi and English. But we still were the best of friends just because we connected over food. And later on, a couple of years back, I went to Peru. And I think that was the time that I had that moment of realization that what a great connector food is. Because we went to this small town called Cusco. Everybody was like, we're taking a nap. I'm like, I'm in Peru. I'm going to walk around. So I went to the Mercado. Vivek, my husband, found me an hour later selling potatoes and making potato croquettes with this old grandma. And let's say my Spanish is not fit for polite company. And she didn't know English. But we still connected. We didn't have to talk because we had the language of food. And that to me is one of the most powerful things of being in the food industry.
Absolutely. What a great story. If my Spanish was any better, I would have asked you the extent of your Spanish. But unfortunately, I don't think either Keith or I can say anything back to you. So.
When we stop recording, I can give you a lowdown on all the words that I
it's kitchen learn. Spanish. Learn a thing or two. That's awesome. Okay, so then you come to America, you go to the CIA, and then you start, the first place you worked at was a restaurant in Jersey, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I went to the CIA, you know, till my 12th grade, I was a student that struggled through school just because that wasn't my calling. And as soon as I went to, you know, hotel administration and culinary, I topped each and every class. So I am graduating thinking that, yes, this is it. I have graduated from the best school in India, the best school in the world. Now the world is mine to conquer. Each and every job offer that I got a lot of job offers, some really coveted, you know, people, you know, chefs that I really wanted to work with. But as soon as I would ask them that my paperwork needed to be sponsored, they would be like, they would drop me, you know, they wouldn't touch me with a barge pole. So that, that became really difficult. And it was, I'm like, okay, what does this mean? So around, and the interesting part is that till that time, I was studying to be a baking and pastry student. Because in India, baking and pastry was not a big thing. So I wanted to learn something which I didn't know. So at that time, my uncle and aunt, they were opening an Indian restaurant. They were like, listen, if you want a job while you're looking around, you know, we can give you a job and we can, you know, sponsor your paperwork, etc. Well, long story short, that was such, at that time, I had a really bad attitude about it because I'm like, who wants to do Indian food? Because I had grown up with it. It was in my backyard. I did not appreciate it as much as I appreciate it now. But at that time, those 4 years taught me how people looked at Indian food and what a great potential there was. And I was also frustrated with the fact that Indian food to a lot of people over here in you know, America meant $8.95 all you can eat greasy buffets, which is not the food that I grew up on. It is, you know, Indian food is seasonal, it's fresh. Farmers market was the only markets that we, you know, went and shopped at. So then it became my passion to tell the whole world about the beauty of Indian food.
I knew we were going to be friends, and that just sealed the deal. Thank you so much for saying that. It's something I talk about all the time. And it sets up the next question perfectly. So I was reading that, and you just mentioned this as well, that you started culinary school and you had a passion for doing pastry, but you switched really because you wanted to showcase your Indian heritage from that savory aspect. So the question that I have is, do you think that there's now a market in America for Indian sweets and pastry, or do you think we're just not there yet?
I don't think that we are there yet. If we are talking about traditional Indian pastries are, it's an obsession in India, right? Like, absolutely. Think about it. Like, I think the sugar level in the traditional Indian desserts, it's at an all-time high. It's like you take a bite of it and it is, you know, you will have a sugar high for the next couple of hours. But that being said, I think that is what the trajectory or the evolution of food is, right? Because when people talk to me, I have this big conversation with people when they talk about, you know, this is not traditional Indian food. So I'm like, okay, you tell me what traditional Indian food is, because tomatoes are not originally from India, you know. Chilies that we so think associate with Indian food, that's not from India, right? I mean, food over centuries has evolved because of what the entire world has gotten, you know, to that particular region. It's the same with desserts. A lot of the desserts have, like, you know, the halwas and stuff. The origin is from, you know, Middle East, Persia. And so to me, I think that if we evolve our desserts into more suiting to the palate over here, including my palate, which has evolved, right? I can't do, like, there was a time I could sit and have 5 to 6 rasgullas, and now I have one, and I'm like, okay, I'm done. All the rasgullas which I make are with lesser sugar because I want to celebrate the different flavors other than sweetness. So, for example, in our restaurant, we do this like a gulab jamun cheesecake, right? We take gulab jamun and we put, you know, we bake it in the cheesecake and make a gulab jamun cheesecake. So I do think that Indian desserts have a place in the American market as long as they are evolved, refined, and the sugar level goes down slightly.
Yeah, I totally agree. And You know, I say all the time, whether it's on my YouTube or here, that I don't think Indian food needs elevation. I think it needs representation. And it's beautiful to see the food starting to be represented on the scale without it changing. And food evolves. I mean, you look at the Maka in New York City and Chef Chintan and the stuff that he's doing in that group. They're unapologetically Indian, which is their slogan. And so I have a lot of hope for what the next bunch of years look like.
But to me, Keith, I've got to tell you, the most heartening part of my conversation with you is your love for Indian food, right? To us, we were born into it. So it is, you know, it is kind of, okay, taken for granted that, of course, we love it because it's a lot of comfort food, right? And for growing up and learning culinary, all we were taught was French techniques, because that is what the epitome of cuisine was considered for the longest time, right? But the fact is, but I learned French food, right? I can make French food better than quite a lot of people, but it boils down to the fact that I was taught French food, and they are people who, you know, who embrace that even though they are not French, and that shows how much reverence that cuisine has around the world. And the fact that you are delving into Indian food, and you're not like skimming the surface of it, the fact that we had this entire conversation about Rogan Josh is you are getting into the nitty-gritties and the depth of it. There are a lot of things that you post, which I'm like, I like regional things, which I'm like, I have no idea what this is. And that's what makes me so excited, that people other than people who are born in India think that the food is beautiful enough and gorgeous enough to explore and own.
Absolutely. I will echo that 100%. I think it's a really refreshing, it's very refreshing to have someone take the kind of interest and give the sort of place that that Keith does with his research. And I just want to go back to one of the things that you were sort of talking about, you know, the tomatoes and the chili and this idea of authenticity. And, you know, for those of us who look at food and we look at food kind of along a continuum, it becomes very obvious that nothing is absolute and that pretty much every cuisine in the world at this point is an amalgamation of years and centuries, as you mentioned, of history and trade and all of these things. But our human memory is so short that we can only think sort of 50 years behind and ahead of us at tops, right? Like it's very difficult for us to conceptualize that things that we did and our parents did and maybe our grandparents did are very new. So, you know, for North Indians, especially for Punjabis, like rajma is one of those things that it's such a staple in our homes, but it's so new in the diet, both rajma and tomatoes and eating rice in Punjab. Like all three of those things are really new to us given the length of our history. So I wanted to ask you, you know, given that what you do with your restaurants is a lot of, you know, bringing Indian flavors to the American palate, bringing what are commonly thought of as Indian spices to the American palate, has there been anything that you've found has really resonated with people, that has really stood out as something that resonated? And conversely, anything that you've sort of seen a lot of, any flavors that you've seen more resistance to than others?
Resistance, I'll start off by saying that anything overly perfumey, let's say a pan, rose, those are things which are really, the expressions that I have seen people once they've had pan is it's priceless. But I think those really aggressive flavors, people are still not used to it. But that being said, to me, I always think that food in the end of the day boils down to the basic essence of the people who are making it. And that's why being over here in the South, there is a lot that resonates when people talk about soul food over here, right? There is a soul in it because there has been, you know, time and love and patience which has been put into the dishes because they take so, you know, they take a really long time to cook. And there's a lot of history and passion. And I do think that that echoes with Indian food also. Like a lot of the dishes that you think are, they take, it takes patience, it takes techniques, it takes years and years of, you know, perfecting the flavors, the arts, mm-hmm. the way the spices dance with each other. I do think that that is it. But there is a lot of commonality also. If I look at over here, black-eyed beans, right? Mm-hmm. Like, people swear by it over here. I mean, I remember it was called rongi, you know, and we would beg our mom like on Sundays to make it. And, you know, it would take a long time to make, soak, make, all of that. So there is a lot more in common with, you know, with food, with foods around than, you know, even the way we eat. Nashville is known for a concept like meat and three, right? You take a meat and then there are three sides. That's how our thalis are, right? If it's a vegetarian, there is one entree with three sides, which could be rice, roti, raita, achar, papad, you know, all of that. So the concept is, you know, it boils down to the soul of the food, and that kind of, you know, it's a check mark.
And you know, one of the things that is also to me really interesting, just while you were talking and you were saying there's so many similarities, the thing I was thinking about is there's so many similarities also when you look at Indian food and Mexican food, and obviously on the US that influence is also really big in terms of the produce. And you see like the cumin and the beans, as you mentioned, and you know, the tomatoes and the potatoes and like all of these staple ingredients. And it's always just fascinating to see how the same set of ingredients shows up in sometimes similar and sometimes really ingenious ways around the world. And when Keith and I kind of do the episodes where we delve into a particular spice, that seems to be something that comes up over and over again, is that, you know, where somewhere they're toasting it, somewhere they're frying it, somewhere they're grinding it. And some of the things they're doing everywhere because it just makes sense to do that with that particular ingredient. So let's maybe move on a little bit to your career in television and talk a little bit about, you know, how did that transition come about?
It was really interesting. I had just moved to, the chef of today is not only required to make really good food, take care of your entire kitchen, be a therapist, but also be ready to be on television as and when required, right? So when I was in Chicago, I was doing a lot of these morning shows and stuff. And when I moved to New York, my PR company secured a spot for me to be competing on Iron Chef. This was, I think, almost 12, 13 years ago. And I competed against Chef Morimoto. You know, Chef Morimoto literally started his career the year I was born. So that was, you know, that was the icon I was going up against. And I tell the whole world that I came a respectable second among two people. That's better than saying that I lost. But from there, Food Network saw something in me and they called me to compete on the next Iron Chef. From there, I was invited to be the guest judge for Chopped. From there, they invited me, the next season, they invited me to be a permanent judge on Chopped. And that's pretty much how it's been. It's like, to me, I always think that if you get an opportunity to get a toe in the door, just blow them away with what you can do and, you know, just be there. Do your homework, be present, and that's how it worked for me. It was very organic. It wasn't something that I thought about much, but it happened.
I want to keep on this vein for a minute. And one of the things that I love to talk about, whether it's at ACF or platforms that I get to, is I talk about the work-life balance or lack thereof, especially in our industry, right? And obviously, you're an incredibly busy woman, from judging TV shows to winning Tournament of Champions. Congratulations, by the way. Writing books, Chat, which is your latest book, is just exceptional. I love it. And of course, your charity work as well. What tips do you have for other entrepreneurs in this space to balance that work and life kind of, you know, balance?
You forgot to mention the toughest job of all, that's being a mom.
Absolutely.
I was going to throw that in there. Yeah, so I'm not to mention.
Yeah, I have a 7 and a 10, which I think is the toughest. You know what? I think what really helps me is that I absolutely love what I do. I love everything that I do, be it, you know, be it traveling, be it being over here and working on menus. I love it. I feel very blessed to be able to do and earn a living doing things that I love. And I think if I've been given that gift, then shame on me for not, you know, really celebrating that. So to me, I think what really works, there is zero concept of balance. It does not exist. But what exists for me and what works for me is that the moment that I find myself in gets 150% of me. So that means that, you know, just before hopping on the podcast, my son and I, we were watching Trolls. And that was it. That moment, you know, my son had 150% of me, right? So to me, that is what really works. I don't think about, you know, like when I'm talking to you guys, I'm not thinking about, you know, my next 2 weeks or 3 weeks. It is just enjoying this moment and living in this moment. And that's what's worked for me. And there are different things which work for different people. But I think, and also giving up the fact that there is that balance, right? Because to me, when we talk about work-life balance, it's a very confusing, these two are very confusing words, because my work is my life, because I enjoy it. I love it. That's my purpose. And then you've got to, like, you know, when I'm traveling, the kids, every morning they get small notes from me. You know, I leave handwritten notes. I leave, you know, each and every dad joke, each and every knock-knock joke. So they know that I am always present. And that's how it goes.
That is beautiful. And there's so much wisdom in that. And I'm sure that you would agree that being a mother and being a wife and doing all this stuff is really the most success in so many ways, because you get to leave a legacy on so many beautiful two children and a husband. And that's, so congratulations on all that, from that success in your life as well.
Thank you. But again, I wouldn't be able to do it if it wasn't for them. If Vivek hadn't been, you know, supporting each other unconditionally, the kids understanding the fact, because I mean, since both of them have been born, I have been traveling, so this is a very normal thing for them. And as long as you have a conversation and they're like, yeah, mommy, just like, you know, go for it, and the support, I wouldn't be able to do it. As simple as that.
I want to throw you a curveball question real quick. If you could greenlight any food TV show and have total control, what would you like to see on TV?
Oh my God. I don't know if you remember this show. It was a British show called The Two Fat Ladies.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I literally, like, I would like to take my sister and me. And she is definitely like completely opposite of fat, but she has a very analytical mind. So with food, you know, I could give her anything, and even if it doesn't taste good, she says, "Oh, that's delicious," as long as I have made it. And I would love to have that ability to do that with her, and just like show her the entire world, the beauty and the world of food, just traveling around the world. So yeah, that would be my dream show.
That sounds incredible. And if you have space for one more, then I think, or two more, Keith and I will tag along and try all the food as well. There was so much in what you said, and I actually had like a sort of pinch me moment where I was like, wow, we're speaking with Chef Mani Chauhan, like what is happening? So I just wanted to share that. I just had that moment internally. And as you were talking about, you know, leaving little notes for your kids and knock knock jokes and sort of staying really present and being 150%, as Keith said, there's such incredible wisdom in that. And one of the reasons I think it's so important that you mentioned that is because with the number of things you do, it would be very natural to assume that your mind is in 100 places at all, you know, at all times, because there are so many things happening at every moment. And so I think that's a really important reminder for all of us, but especially anyone who's entrepreneurial in any way, that actually it's that dedication to each task that allows it to be successful, however, you know, however long it is, whether it's 5 minutes or 7 hours of service, like it's that kind of dedication that allows it to be really successful. And when you talked about sort of leaving the jokes, my mind literally went, sigh, and she's a perfect mom too.
Far from perfect. I don't believe in perfection. I think perfection is absolutely boring. I do think that, just a little bit of masala in your life makes things more interesting. So yeah, so there's nothing about me which is even remotely perfect.
And just going back to TV, I just wanted to ask for your reflections on being and this may not be something that is relevant, so I don't want to ask this question in a way that assumes that it was, you know, a major factor in anything that you've done, but maybe it is. And so one of the questions that I had is, you know, on TV, working with restaurants, especially that you're now in Nashville, which I don't know, but I'm assuming that maybe Indian food is not as popular, say, as it is in New York or maybe some other cities in the US. How has what has it meant to you to be a South Asian woman in this space? What are some of the challenges maybe that you may have faced, may not have faced? What are some of the advantages you might have had because of it? Just any reflections on that?
You know what? I mean, to me, the fact is, you know, I'm very proud of where I've come from. I'm very proud at where I have reached. The journey has not been easy. But I also acknowledge the fact that anybody who's successful, their journeys have not been easy, right? No matter how much you've been given, or no matter how much, you know, or how much of a, you know, jump start you had, everybody's journey has been very difficult, right? And there are always things which would set people apart. Be it, you know, the color of their skin, their gender. So I have never given that a thought when I have been moving, because to me, it's always keep putting one foot in front of the other and giving my best. But I do acknowledge and really appreciate the fact that that I am where I am, because you do not see many people who look like me or even sound like me or even have an accent like me, you know, on a national platform. And I'm very grateful for that. And that is something that I celebrate by, like, you know, like Tournament of Champions, right? I go ahead and I wear my, you know, these chef jackets that I've specially had made from India. These are silks which are sourced from there. I have local, you know, the karigars or the workers who are working on it. Because now that I have a daughter and a son of my own, I need to show to them that you should be really comfortable in your skin. No matter where you are from, you are judged on your capabilities. And, you know, and that's what it is. Has that opened doors for me? I don't know. Nobody has ever told me that. Have I at times felt, you know, at a disadvantage? Maybe, but I don't know, because nobody has told me that. And, you know, and if there is white noise around which people are saying things, I frankly don't care. Because over here, I have worked so hard to reach where I have, that there'll always be naysayers. Let there be, that's their problem, not mine. And that's what I keep on telling the kids. You know, when they come back from school that, you know, they've had a tough day, I'm like, okay, if somebody was mean to you, that's their problem, not yours. And just keep on moving on, one step in front of the other.
Absolutely. And it's so funny. I was smiling when you were saying that, because there's one of my favorite books is a book from Don Miguel Ruiz called The Four Agreements. And in it, one of the agreements is not to take things personally. And it's such an important tool that, unfortunately, in my life, it took me a long time to get there where I, you know, we work so hard and we're passionate. But that's such a skill to have. But I want to bring, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, and also think about it. It's, we keep on telling ourselves that don't take it personally, right? But in the end of the day, like, you know, things do, like, at times I'm on, so, I mean, I have just told my kids and my nieces and nephews that they're not getting on social media because, you know, social media has, even though it's such a, I'm on it all the time and it's such a blessing, but at times people just reach out to you and say the most random thing and you, and it upsets you. Like, and I keep on telling, I'm like, I'm 45 years old and it still upsets me. I can't imagine what a 10-year-old is going to think about it. So things do affect, but you've got to kind of train yourself to just let it roll over.
Yeah. And it's such a skill. It's such a skill. I want to bring it back to the quote that I love that you started this with. You said, do something you love and people love you for it. Well, there are so many people across this world at this point who love you for all that you've done in your career. And when I was younger, a mentor of mine gave me this piece of advice. They said, if you really want to know your idols, ask them who their idols and mentors are. So who are the people you look up to and aspire to be like?
I wish I could give you one name. I can't. Because to me, I think one of the biggest things that I do is I get inspired by each and every person that I come across or I talk to. Because you've got to realize each and every person has something so unique about them that that is something that is really awe-inspiring. So I have you know, drawn inspiration from, you know, the people who've made it big in not only the food industry, but, you know, in industry as a general, to people who have been my colleagues, who still are my colleagues. I draw inspiration from Vivek, from the kids, from their teachers, from, you know, my chefs, my servers, my managers, my dishwashers. Because if I let a single day go without meeting somebody who's taught me something, then I've wasted a day. So, I mean, like right now, talking to both of you, that is inspiration to me. You know, like, I am inspired by the fact that you guys are giving a voice to a cuisine which is so ancient. And that is inspiring to me. You're taking the time, you're making the effort to do that. So yes, there is not a single person who I have come across who hasn't inspired me in a good way or a bad way. I'm not saying that it's always positive. At times, I have learned from people what not to do. And that's what, to me, life is all about.
That is absolutely perfect. I know Rockin' was jumping in there, too, because we're both, I just want to say we're both very humbled to hear that we could be any source of inspiration, not only for you, for anyone who listens to this. It's like, we always say we're just spice nerds. so much. So thank you. That's super kind.
That's very, very gracious and kind of you to say. But I think, you know, as you were talking, I was just thinking to not take things personally is such an incredible skill. And, you know, it's something that you kind of need to do, because there'll always be people cheering you on, and there'll always be people who you know, aren't, for whatever reason, whatever it is. And as you said, it's kind of their thing to grapple with more than it is yours, because you're on a path, and that's kind of in the direction that we have to keep going. So just to wrap this up, I have like four or five questions here, but I'm conscious of the time. And so I'm going to try and choose the two that I think would be good to end with. But so last couple of questions, I'm really interested to understand, because your menu at your restaurant in Nashville is super, it's really interesting from the perspective of what you're bringing together for each dish, right? Like you can very clearly see the influence and the final dish. And so what I'm really interested to understand is your approach or process to ideating for what is a fusion sort of menu.
You know, it's so interesting. People are, over the last couple of years, the word fusion has gotten a really bad rap. But to me, I think what it is just celebrating different concepts, which are so fun. You know, for example, Vivek and I, we had gone to Montreal and we were in Montreal. We're like, of course, we've got to have poutine. Everybody talks about poutine. And mm-hmm. we had poutine and, you know, after one beer too many, we looked at each other. We're like, this needs flavor. This needs chicken tikka masala on it with uigui cheese. And we're like, okay, so that's on our menu, right? And it is, I mean, it's delicious. It's our highest selling item, you know. And it also is a great icebreaker for people who've never had Indian food. They're like, oh, fries, tomato sauce, cheese. How can we go wrong with chicken? How can we go wrong? And they're like, huh, these flavors are interesting. And then they foyer into other things. We've got lamb keema nachos. And my mouth is watering talking to you guys about this because I'm getting really hungry. But that's it. Like, I really love the food that we have on our menu. And that's how we keep on evolving. But we do have our traditional, you know, tandoori dishes and our traditional mm-hmm. curries, which makes it so much fun. We've got this French onion naan, which we do with this vindaloo braised short rib and caramelized onions and Gruyere cheese, which is so
oh my great. God.
it's so fun. But if you think about it, I mean, think about, you know, Indian, you know, food in India as such, right? There is this, you know, Goa. Goa was occupied by Portuguese. So the cuisine over there is incredible. It's Indian-Portuguese mix, right? Or Pondicherry, which is French. It was occupied by French. So French-Indian. Or Eastern India, which has like Tangra cuisine, which is Chinese and Indian, which, by the way, I think is the best rendition of, you know, fusion Chinese food. But that's, I think that's what it is. Like, you evolve with time, you stay true to your roots, but also allow yourself to grow and explore and have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love
that. I just realized why you're asking me two of the four questions, because I just go on a tangent and just don't stop.
No, oh my goodness. I think Heath and I would sit here for 6 hours to listen to you. So, final question would be, so we have, you know, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are people who either are, you know, have some sort of food presence on social media or work in the food industry or just have a very deep interest in food. So what are two pieces of advice that you would give people who are looking to learn more about Indian food?
My first biggest piece of advice is stop being afraid. People are so afraid. They're like, oh my God, Indian food is difficult. Actually, it isn't. I mean, recently I've started making these reels, which just show how easy cooking Indian food is. And till the time you don't try it, you're not going to let that fear go. So you have to take the first step. That to me is one of the biggest advice on, you know, on getting started on trying Indian food. My second piece of advice would be that cook your spices. Like, as simple as that, cook your spices. Half of the times when you eat Indian food which doesn't taste really good, that's because the spices haven't been cooked out. You have to let those spices. I always say that, you know, when I'm starting a dish, my favorite thing to say is, I heat some oil, I put some cumin seeds, I put some mustard seeds, you know, some asafoetida, some curry leaves, and I'm like, now let these spices sing and dance. And we are not looking for ballroom dancing, we are looking for rock and roll, because that's the time you know that the spices have released their true flavors and potential into the oil, which is going to be the bloodline of the entire dish, and it's going to flavor the entire dish. So those are the two biggest things. I could go on and on for hours to the do's and the don'ts. But the biggest thing is get over the fear. Indian food is really not, it's, you know, I hate to say it, and a lot of people would hate me to say it, but it's not rocket science. Follow your instinct, follow your flavors, you know, if you like something, go ahead, experiment. That's the fun part about cooking.
It's a perfect way to end this. Manit, thank you not just for being on this podcast, but thank you for being authentically and truly you.
Honestly. Yeah.
This has been such a great time. I'm blown away. I've learned so much, and you inspire us, and I'm sure so many of our listeners say the same. So thank you, and we'd love to have you back anytime. Man, there's so much more we could talk about.
You guys are too kind. Yes, absolutely. I would love to be back and continue more in-depth conversations about Indian food.
Thank you guys for listening. And Ragini, any final words?
No, I'm just now thinking of making a gulab jamun cheesecake, to be honest. That's kind of next on my agenda now. I think I need to go and try that. Thank you so much, Manit, for being here. It's been, I mean, Keith has said everything that has to be said. I think it's just more of the same, like so much wisdom. And we're honestly just so honored that you would be on this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.